This is Theatre Voice. I'm David Benedict, and I want to register a protest. The National Theatre has seen fit to present His Girl Friday, a scurrilous and quite possibly scandalous indictment of the entirely honourable ladies and gentlemen of the press, three of whom join me here in the studio to discuss this shocking state of affairs. They are Mark Shenton of the Sunday Express, Matt Wolfe of Variety, and Rachel Halliburton of the Evening Standard. His Girl Friday is, of course, ostensibly a reworking of Hollywood's quintessential screwball comedy of the same name, starring sparring partners Cary Grant as wily newspaper editor Walter Burns, and Rosalind Russell as ace reporter Hildegard Johnson, known as Hildy. But before anyone leaps to the conclusion that this is yet another limp theatrical movie makeover, following in the lame footsteps of The Graduate, consider the pedigree. His Girl Friday began life on Broadway in 1928 as the comedy The Front Page. In the original, Hildegard was Hildebrand, and that was how Lewis Milestone famously filmed it in 1931. It was director Howard Hawks who made the sex change, turning it into His Girl Friday in 1940, but it doesn't end there. Billy Wilder reverted to the men-only original for his overly acidic, oddly humourless version in 1974 with Walter Matthau as Walter and Jack Lemmon overdoing his typical Jack Lemmonisms as Hildy. And in 1988, Ted Kotcheff moved the action from newspapers to TV, hiring Burt Reynolds and Kathleen Turner for switching channels. This new version by John Guare, most famously the author of 6 Degrees of Separation, borrows the sex change, the snappy repartee, and the late 1930s dateline from the Howard Hawks movie, and places it back in the original front page structure. The mile-a-minute action is all set on one night in the press room of the Chicago Criminal Courts building, and follows the story of accidental anarchist Earl Holub, who finds himself on the wrong side of the law, in the wrong place, in the wrong time. He shoots a policeman and is now headed for the gallows. When he breaks out of jail, the reporters go wild, none more so than Hildy and her ex-husband and ex-boss Walter, played here by Zoe Wanamaker and Alex Jennings, directed by Jack O'Brien. So, Mark Shenton, did this version make you want to yell, "Hold the front page"?
Not exactly, but I came to it fairly fresh. I've never seen the film on which it's based, I'm ashamed to say. And of course, I think all of us are too young to have seen the 1971 National Theatre production that set a landmark for the play, the original play. But it, after a very slow start, it gradually builds this production, and eventually I was won over.
Matt Wolfe, do you think they should have left well alone and just done the front page, or were you happy?
No, I was very glad to see this, because the front page seems to be done quite a lot in Britain. Chichester just did it, and Sam Mendes did, I thought, a not very inspired production of it some years ago at the Dalmar as a kind of Christmas show. And I really liked this version a lot. It seemed to me very fresh and very funny. I wasn't sure I would like it, but by the end it got me.
Did it get you, Rachel Halliburton?
I felt I had to work incredibly hard to have a good time, but I think this was partly to do with where I was seated. I started off with a £10 ticket seat, and I was sitting right at the top of the circle. And in the Olivier, when you got repartee, which is as fast-moving, I mean, indeed, it's the signature of this play, you have very fast-moving repartee, and I think it's very difficult to appreciate that so far back. For the second half, I'm afraid to say I'd spotted empty seats in the stalls and came down and started to enjoy it a lot more. But I think by then, anyway, the chemistry had started to simmer a lot more.
I do think that this is a play that is always hard to get going. In the Hawks movie, he invented a whole 20-minute section which kicks the movie off much, much faster. This production sticks with the original text pretty much to begin with and does the scene in the Chicago Criminal Courts building. And you get this great big portrait of newspaper life and cynical journalists not being interested in a story unless it's got full-blooded Americans in it. They sort of reject a Polish story. Does it build enough, do you think? Do you think this is the right space for this play, Mark?
Well, the Olivier is always a classically problematic theatre, and especially for comedy. Comedy hardly ever works there. But what they were clever to do here is to give it a setting, a one-set setting, that's partly dictated by the £10 season, because they were scenically restricted. But by doing it out front there, and giving this kind of film-within-a-film device, doing it in kind of black and white, like City of Angels did once upon a time, that kind of gave it an immediate context and told you where you were. I think the problem is that with a cast of 30 people, it's a massive cast, to get you're involved with that number of people quickly is very hard in any space, and the Olivier diffuses you even more.
Is that a view you share?
Yeah, although I have to say I was kind of confused by the set initially, although I thought it was very attractive and I liked the kind of black and white and shades of grey nature of it, but I couldn't quite figure out what it was really saying, aside from the fact that this is a play of a film of a play, so it seemed to be kind of a commentary on that. I couldn't really figure it out. It seemed kind of fussy.
It feels to me as if, actually, one of the reviews this morning criticises that extra layer of set that you have around it. It seems to me that actually probably was not an idea that came up originally. I think that's a design idea, because this is a play that needs entrances and exits. And in an open space like the Olivier, you can't do it. I longed to be sitting in the Littleton watching it, where people can come on and yes. And then they slam the door and they vanished. Mm. This absolutely is a Pross Arch play. And I suspect that in order to animate the space around the set, they come up with this framing device, which, for me, doesn't really seem to work.
Actually, a couple of times I thought it was a little over-animated. Like, for instance, there were several scenes, including the scene that ends the first act, or, you know, leading into the interval, where you think, okay, great, and you're going out, and then there's business still happening on stage, and people in the audience were going up the aisle and then turning around, thinking, oh, should we be heading back to our seat? And that was sort of odd.
I think that was because, actually, this show has only had 6 or 7 previews, and it needs a lot more to get it running. Actually, there was a really late sound cue. There should be some music which comes smack on at the end of the show. Mm. And it arrived about 5 seconds later. 5 seconds at the end of an act is a very long time. Mm. Do you think that, despite the lack of previews, Rachel, that the chemistry is working in this production, which is so essential?
Well, you see, I think it's very interesting that they decided to go back to the original beginning instead of going with a Howard Hawks start, because I thought, obviously, the way that how this production lives and dies is by the chemistry between the two main characters. And again, I thought, because Olivier is such a large space, rather than having this very kind of piecemeal build-up of, you know, what the atmosphere was like on this Chicago newspaper, I thought to actually go straight in with the personal chemistry between Walter Burns and between Hildy would have been a better way to start. I saw it in preview, and at that point I didn't think that the chemistry was working so well between Zoe Wanamaker and Alex Jennings. You know, Zoe Wanamaker with her slightly kind of prickly, sort of wounded hedgehog style sort of sexuality, and Alex Jennings, who is a wonderful actor, but you can't imagine him doing anything sexual not in socks. and I didn't feel that either of them overcame that really until very late into the second half, when you saw sort of things work between them. However, it didn't matter so much, because in this play, sex is about journalism, and that really did come across very strongly.
Do you think, now that you saw it slightly later, you saw it on press night, do you think that chemistry is working?
Definitely. And I think Zoe Wanamaker is such a wonderfully instinctive comedy actress, and being also originally born of American parents, she also has that whole American sensibility that goes with it. I mean, I think maybe Alex Jennings isn't quite there yet, whereas Zoe Wanamaker is always sublime. I mean, I think back to Once in a Lifetime. The brilliant RSC production of another period comedy. She's always done this kind of thing.
She won the Olivier for that. Mm. Do you think that it was a good idea, Matt, to get Jack O'Brien, an American director, to do this play? Do you think that it has gained from that kind of knowledge of the rhythm?
I think so, although I have to say that I don't think Jack's the only director who could have done it. I mean, there are plenty of British directors who could have done it, and that famous National Front Page was directed by Michael Blakemore. On the other hand, Jack does know a lot about zinging a line across the footlights. I mean, for God's sake, he directed Hairspray, which is almost 3 hours of that. And he's also good, as his Broadway production, The Invention of Love, proved triumphantly, at sort of finding the feeling beneath the surface, and I actually thought that was what I responded to by the end of this. I did feel for the two of them, and I did think that they were coming together quite movingly.
I do think that it is sometimes regarded as just, you know, a scabrous view of the press, and it's very funny, and that's it, and that absolutely O'Brien and the production managed to fill it with a lot more colours than you might expect, or indeed than the set and costume design would suggest is all you're going to get. I particularly thought there were some very, very good bit part performances. I mean,
wonderful,
lovely Nathan Osgood, Bensinger, the poet,
Prissy poet,
played is very, very good. I mean, gets an enormous laugh when he stands there and goes, "There's been a jailbreak," and it's very, very funny. There's lots of details.
But you know, for instance, the Molly Malloy, which on film, because I just watched the film again a few weeks ago, and in the front page is almost unendurable.
The Wilder
cliche
version,
yeah. Oh, Carol Burnett, isn't it?
Yeah,
but I thought in this production she was pretty good with a very thankless part, and you actually felt for her briefly.
I mean, I think it's interesting to compare this with the Wilder version, because the Wilder version is so 1974, it's so convinced of its politics, it's so convinced that it's going to give you a searing portrait of the horrors of the press, that actually it's not funny. Mm-hmm. It is really strangely... It has all the things that Billy Wilder was accused of, and actually usually didn't inhabit. You know, deep, deep, abiding cynicism. Wilder is cynical, but he's not that unpleasant most of the time. Mm-hmm. Actually, this production also makes you see, I think, how wrong-footed that film version is, and that there is a large amount of warmth. Otherwise, I think watching it would be unendurable if you had 3 hours.
Well, it's a bit like the lumbering version of Arsenic and Old Lace that we've recently had in the West End. I mean, that just shows you how a director who's not in command of the material can command a cast giving completely different performances from each other and not being on the same page at all. Whereas this production shows what can happen if a director does know the rhythms and honours them and respects them.
In His Girl Friday, someone once timed human speech in movies at something like 110 words a minute, and in the Hawks movie, they reached 240 words a minute. Was this production fast enough for us?
And here we speak at 260 words a minute.
Well, actually, one of the things I liked about this a lot is that if you watch the film now, it has a kind of rat-a-tat quality. It's like listening to a lot of woodpeckers kind of talking at each other. And that's exciting, but it's kind of exhausting, and it doesn't allow much room for the characters to breathe. I thought this actually gave more space to the characters in a very nice way. You felt that they were human beings, not just sort of spouters of witticisms.
What do you think that John Guare brought to the mix, other than the mating of basically the two texts?
Well, I had, certain critics have raised issues with what he lost, which is they were worried that he, for instance, didn't emphasise America's isolationist stance at the beginning of World War II, and these kind of wonderful dismissings of, what was it, Neville Chamberlain, and, yes, you know, his kind of, you know, pronouncements at the beginning of the war and saying, oh, just put that on the funny page. And in some senses, I was just thinking, well, how much further did he really need to go within the context of this play without making it about something completely different? I mean, for me, what he managed to do very nicely was capture that kind of the humour and the pace of a newsroom, which anybody who's been in a newsroom has experienced, without either making the romantic side or the political side too gratuitous.
There's some very funny exchanges that are John Guare, as far as I know. I mean, I don't have the Howard Hawks script memorized, but I mean, there's one bit where somebody wants coffee with rum in it, and they say the rum cuts the heat, and then Alex Jennings says they're practically freezing in Cuba. Yeah. That was just such a great line.
And also, he gives Margaret Tysak, who is quite wonderful, as the terrible fiancée's even worse mother, who comes in a demon in fox fur. She has this wonderful riff where she lets rip at her prospective daughter-in-law about women writers. And it's this gag that just builds and builds and builds with Edith Wharton was a traitor to her class, and
culminates with Agatha Christie.
And what a combination!
She comes back again with more, which is wonderful.
It won't quite make the front page, but it'll make a very good feature on page 3. Matt Wolfe, Mark Shenton, Rachel Halliburton, thank you very much.